Astraea.
Jade.
How are you doing this week?
I have been doing absolutely fantastic. I have had a lovely week.
I have too. It's been quite good. I've been lost in the sauce, as one would say. lost in the analytical sauce on our latest topic, Fuzzy Nights by Noah J.D. Chin. From 2002 to today, technically.
Yeah. No, there was a 20-year hiatus in the middle there, but it's back.
Yeah. We had read this one when it was of the time, and I had forgotten a lot of things about it. Chiefly, I forgot how much it leaned on tabletop RPG stuff. And I should point out here, as we begin, that's actually kind of a big hole in my, like, nerd experience. Like, I do a lot of nerdy things, but... I've never actually sat down to finish a whole campaign of a tabletop RPG. That's just one of those things that's escaped me, and I've learned most of my stuff through osmosis from others. What's your history with this comic?
This was the first webcomic I ever read. I was poking around, but I think it was like the official Discworld forums, and there was a list of suggested webcomics. I had gotten through tabletop gaming through the Discworld role-playing game. I was kind of Pratchett-obsessed at this point. I was very, very into tabletop RPGs. I was very immersed in the culture. That was like one of my main ways of socializing in my shitty small hometown. And I was just, you know, as often happens, I became enmeshed in obsessively researching all of this. At a time, it was significantly harder to do that. 'Cause you couldn't just find... You know, like I didn't have a ton of money. What I had access to was like what came into my shitty small town. But Fuzzy Nights was a window into that. I liked it a lot because I was 13.
I mean, yeah, I was too. So,
and it was like, hey, game jokes. It's game jokes. And then like got pulled in because like, you know, this is when I'm getting used to the idea, like getting excited about the idea of like stories having power. And a lot of the stuff that this comic becomes very fixated on as it goes.
So Fuzzy Nights is a little unique. It is not hosted on like a traditional webcomic site. This being in 2002, this is like just a little early for like CMSs and WordPress and Comic Press to become standard issue for webcomics.
Yeah.
And Fuzzy Nights, unfortunately, one of our big problems in this episode is that Fuzzy Nights is not archived well. The original website has gone down, and archive.org has only like incomplete captures. So I had to read this in bits and pieces, and I'm basically out of order, just finding whatever I could, whatever links did work. Okay, so Fuzzy Nights is actually hosted on Kenzerco, Kenzer and Company, the publishing house that produced Hackmaster,
a role-playing game.
The role-playing game, like for real, like not as a,
yeah.
Yes, it's an independent project, but it is officially also a Kenzerco project, which I think that might be unique among all webcomics.
Yeah. Honestly. And to, you know, contextualize Kenzerco a little, Kenzer and Company, well, it predates publishing Knights at the Dinner Table, because Knights at the Dinner Table, the gamer comic of like, lol, players are bad. The GM's trying to, you know, force them down their story. And then horrible things happen and they all betray each other. And while Kenzer and Company predated that, their public, I would say mostly Kenzer and Company existed after a certain point, and to now pretty much entirely exist to publish Knights at the Dinner Table and like a handful of their in-house RPGs, which started as jokes in Knights of the Dinner Table, most notably Hackmaster, which is a really, really intentionally over-convoluted parody of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons that they got so lost in the sauce on that they started liking as a real game.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Making a game out of references to what was supposed to be a joke about how unplayably bad Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st and 2nd Edition were, and then just deciding you like that after you make the real thing, is completely unique in tabletop RPG history.
Yeah, a lot of this gives me, not just Fuzzy Nights, but what you tell me about Kenzerco, gives me like nerd garage business vibes.
Yeah.
Like this is still of an, it's like, this is a business model of the time when like Richard Garriott was selling Ultima via floppies out of his mom and dad's garage.
Yeah. And yeah. Knights at the Dinner Table goes back to the 90s. So yeah, like it started as a backup in a fanzine that became a real magazine called Shadus. Yeah, but that's not super important. The important thing is that that comic became kind of everything, and it became a gaming magazine slash comic that would have ongoing adventures of the Knights at the Dinner Table. They're a dysfunctional playgroup. And Fuzzy Knights was originally Fuzzy Knights on the Dinner Table, and the joke was, hey, what if they were stuffed animals? And it was a one-panel comic that was a joke, and then it got expanded to one comic, and then it got expanded into an ongoing gag-a-day comic, and then the webcomics curse hit it, and it became an epic story where people fucking die.
Yeah, Fuzzy Knights falls down the webcomic slide, the webcomic curve slide, pretty fast.
Yeah,
not that it's not fun. I always loved observing that in webcomics, is that like things always start small, but the authors always want to do more, and so things tend to expand and get bigger, and the casts get larger, and the stakes get higher, et cetera, until it's completely unrecognizable from like the small gag a day thing it started as. I don't know why that phenomenon persists in so many webcomics, but it definitely does. Fuzzy Knights is unique in a lot of ways, but it's one of the first and I think only, I almost never see this format. It's a photograph comic.
Yeah.
It's when we say this is stuffed animals on the dinner table, we mean literal photos of literal stuffed animals on tiny little sets with little bitty props. And it's very eye-catching. No other webcomic really looks like this, or at least yeah. I haven't read one.
It's predated by a comic called Leisure Town, which is more conscientiously surreal, and probably its clearest predecessor, Irregular Webcomic, which was made with Legos. This kind of thing is only really in webcomics. I haven't really seen a lot of print-first comics go, we're going to use photography as our primary source.
I don't think I have. Fuzzy Knights stars a huge cast of literal toys and stuffed animal characters, but our chief four characters are Mossfoot the Green Bear, who's the game master. He's kind of like, his personality I mostly compared to Kermit, Kermit the Frog. He's very level-headed, very earnest, but also has a tendency to lose his temper when the house comes crashing down around him because of his idiot friends.
Yes.
There's Target the Cat, who I think has probably the weakest personality. He's just like, he's the new guy. He's a little nebbish, a little nerdy, and he's smart, but like not confident.
He's supposed to be a ladies' man, but this comes up in like four comics.
Yeah, they don't press that angle very hard. There's Violet, who is Taranga Leela from Futurama. She is a 2000s single female. She's just one of the dudes. She likes punching and kicking and violence, just like the guys do.
Except she's not single. She's heavily involved with Mossfoot.
That's a nerd in the 2000s idea of a feminist character.
Yep.
And then there's Ben, the quintessential character in any role-play game story. He's the problem player. He has enormous power fantasies. He does not listen. He does his level best to try and win a game of play pretend with all his friends. He exists to either be the punchline or set up punchlines for other characters.
Yeah. He's also literally just a Benjamin Bunny plush.
Is he?
Yep.
What's a Benjamin Bunny?
Benjamin Bunny would be the Beatrix Potter story, the less known rabbit than Peter Rabbit.
Oh, I don't think I've ever heard that one.
Hmm. Yeah, I'd never heard
new every day.
Yeah, but I vaguely heard of it, and yeah, no, it's Benjamin Bunny.
Yeah, so the format of Fuzzy Knights is pretty straightforward, and most of it is this gang of four characters running into either mishaps in their own tabletop campaign or tabletop culture interactions with their other friends who appear at like a little bar, which is just a bunch of cardboard boxes stacked together with like little scribbles on the side. It's like the effort. I love the effort this author puts into like setting up sets and there's a lot of location shoots in this comic, which I did not expect. They go all over the place.
All of these locations and what is vaguely defined, but clearly Japan.
It's clearly Japan until they move to the UK, and then it's London. I especially love in the London chapter that the little shoot they do inside the old time red telephone booth.
Yeah.
And like they're crawling all over the payphone trying to get it to work at their tiny little size. It's like, this is really clever. He puts a lot of thought into these things.
Yeah, and that's a later strip, because like one of the things I think is stronger as the strip goes on is it starts taking more and more advantage of the context of them being little stuffed animals. Uh-huh. More so than the earlier strips, which is just like, hey, the daddy bear's playing D&D.
I have a lot of gripes with this comic, but I did largely have a really fun time reading this. It's just silly.
The enthusiasm is infectious.
They are playing a game called Hackmaster. Would you like to... Do you know anything else about Hackmaster besides the fact that it's like an intentional exaggeration of D&D?
It is intentionally convoluted. The game is designed to facilitate player backstabbing. The combat... The tool to help you understand it is literally called the combat wheel, which I saw a physical one back when I was in high school. It spin. It was like multiple layers of spinning, like laminated paper, which would have little numbers on it that would have something to do with the game. I don't know what, but everything about it was incredibly fucking convoluted. At some point, they switch from playing basic Dungeons & Dragons, a pretty okay RPG considering its time, to Hackmaster, which is a nightmarish joke. It seems very likely connected to the fact that they were published by this. There were additional fuzzy nights.
It's in a weird way, it's product placement.
Yeah.
Which is something that I don't think I've ever seen a webcomic do before.
Yeah, and this... There were additional Fuzzy Night strips, original ones that were published in Knights at the Dinner Table that were not the same ones as the ones on the web.
Yeah. So, like, this is an interesting business model we haven't seen before. Like, they're actually published. Like, it's a need nerd. It's a niche. Blah. A niche nerd product published by a niche nerd company in, like, a sort of symbiotic relationship. I can't think of any other example in webcomics that does this.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, everything else I can think of that got anywhere near that was, like, you know, Homestuck starts selling merch based on its own stuff. Like,
yeah, but, like, that's not a symbiotic relationship the way this is, playing a parody of the tabletop game, which is itself a real product that you can actually buy.
And one more layer, which is that they're playing Hackmaster 4.5, a fictional game to explain all of the...
Yeah, a fictional fudge version, because there was no 4.5.
Yeah.
which, it's just... This author is actually quite good at bouncing around the metafiction of teddy bears on a table. They also seem to get kind of stuck in there, though. How do I describe this? Fuzzy Nights has a real problem holding a consistent tone. Do you know, this is kind of like the Toy Story setup, right?
Yeah. And
like Toy Story didn't create this, the premise of the living toy. That's a very old trope. But this is the same sort of setup where, like, the toys are alive when the humans aren't looking at them. And theoretically, they could interact with people if they could see them. But do you know how, like, in Toy Story, part of the humor is that these are children's toys dealing with deep metafictional concepts like abandonment and immortality and loss. And, like, that's just part of the comedy in its own way, is, like, how seriously they have to take these things and, like, they're literal kids' toys.
Yeah.
It's like the contrast between very adult topics and very childish things. Fuzzy Nights nails that beat too, except it cannot decide between is that concept funny or dramatic or both, and it tends to lean on dramatic in a way that it's not quite good at.
Yeah.
Am I making sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing where imagine if Toy Story, like, not just having, like, the rules of how toys work in Toy Story, but there is a nerd monologue in the middle explaining the conceptual metaphysics that is a key part of the question of the plot of the comic.
Yeah, and when you read this weird spiel about how this is how toys come to life, and it's strange and bizarre and crazy, and like it clearly makes no sense at all, and like you laugh when that happens, but then
it's the crux of the entire rest of the comic.
And the characters take it deadly serious and treat it like actual gospel from Christ, and yeah. like they treat it with such gravity, and yet they are still tiny toys yeah. on the dinner table. It's like, I can't, for the life of me, I can't tell how seriously I'm supposed to take this. Is the fact that they're so serious, is that the joke? Or is it the appeal of the drama? I don't think the author can decide.
I don't think that part's a joke. I think he was trying to do Terry Pratchett and Douglas Adams.
Yeah, I definitely detect a distinct love of Douglas Adams, although he doesn't have the British schoolmaster snide that Douglas Adams' yeah. writing does. That trademark sneer that the narrator always has.
And he doesn't have the real world grounding that's the actual secret sauce of the Discworld books, that they're very grounded and often based on actual stuff more than they are genre parody.
Most of what this comic concerns, in fact, is social interaction, like social tensions, which brings me to a funny thing. So I actually have heard of the RPGA, or the D&D Adventurers Association, yep. as I think it's called today, because I have friends who did play tabletop RPGs and they complained about it a lot. The Fuzzy Knights end up like inside the dramas of their own RPGA group.
And yeah, this is something that like theoretically some vestige of it still exists, but it was essentially an organized play for tabletop role-playing games that literally had tournaments that you could keep your character from session to session and play in multiple other games. You could win games?
Yeah.
Question mark? I've never understood this my entire life.
Well, the way it was once described to me is that like in a time before the internet is like in wide usage, like in the mid 80s, early 90s, yeah. This is a way to have like mass multiplayer play in this hobby you like, which theoretically could be possible, and it wouldn't be until like chat rooms and like chat clients became a thing. But that was the appeal, is like having a big interconnected campaign. It felt like your whole town, when you had an RPGA association in your town, was on a big multiplayer, like in, yeah. in a muck or a mud, basically, a large shared universe. In practice, though, just learning what it was about and how it was run, this sounds like a fucking cauldron for nerd arguments. Like, this sounds like a horrible engine for creating enormous petty disputes.
Playing the game is so important to you, you will find people to play the game regardless of whether or not they're people you actually would be around in any other context.
Yeah, like you are so desperate to get your hobby fix, you don't care who you're doing it with.
Yes, and TSR yeah. and then Wizards of the Coast use this to make a buck.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It just sounds like a fucking pain in the ass. Like, that sounded... Why did y'all put up with this? This sounded like it sucked. You mean yeah. I have to get my magic items certified by a referee before I'm allowed to use them anywhere else? That sucks. Why is that a rule?
Yeah, well,
who cares?
You need to keep a balance between the games because people would cheat and they'd be like, "Oh, I got this much XP and that's why I'm so cheat? Much better
it's
than you."
D&D.
It's yeah, no, it was a bad time.
I believe you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, and then there was, like, a feedback loop, because I remember, like, at least the teenagers I was playing with would think all of the dysfunctional stuff was really funny and intentionally, like, do it, and then people would use the parodies as saying, that's just how it is, so you can't do anything about it. It was this miserable cycle, just maladjusted rage that, ironically, the popularity of, as much as I even maligned them myself, the actual play podcast kind of fixed a lot.
There's a big, like, tournament war arc, which is, like, the gang go to one of these RPGA tournaments and, like, actually earnestly try to win. And if what's depicted in, like, this tournament war arc is anything like how real tournaments worked, I'm like, this is dumb. did somebody really get, like, a 25-point bonus just for having the best banner at the intro day?
You made
your own flag.
That stuff is intentionally grandiose. That was that was like, because role playing is like a cornerstone of stuffed animal existence of this comic.
Yeah, it's really odd.
Yeah, it's almost manga-esque in a lot of ways. Like,
yeah, it is kind of like a manga where like the topic of the manga is like forced into being the most important thing in the universe, like soccer is in Inazuma Eleven, or Beyblade is, or like how Yu-Gi-Oh cards are. They're like literally tied to the fabric of the universe somehow. Yeah. I don't know. That's not without precedent.
It's conceivable manga was an influence on this.
Unfortunately, I have to say that the narrator and Mossfoot by extension have a really bad habit of like going on epic speeches, or like speeches they think are epic. Because like when Mossfoot starts opening his mouth and like going on about how, oh, the story is the way of life, like it's the fucking Force, basically, like right down to the Yoda parody. It's like, my eyes just glaze over. It's like, it's a teddy bear. You can't get me to take it seriously. I'm sorry.
There's a point where the teddy bear, like, and it's a great, it was a sequence I found myself grinning through, but there's a point where the teddy bear is doing martial arts with a katana. You can't tell me to take this, like, as seriously as it wants me to take it.
Yeah, the teddy bear does, like, the martial arts with the katana, and, like, they do the dramatic zoom out in, like, the last few pages of the comic. I was like, okay, now there's a tell here. If this is meant to be a joke and a comedy bit, then the last page of your comic with the dramatic zoom out has somebody trip, or like some other idiot come in from off screen. It's like, oh, hey guys, I'm here. Like you ruined the dramatic moment with a little tiny, like half beat of comedy. And the author does not do that. The dramatic moment just hangs, and you're supposed to think of it as a dramatic moment with no punchline. It's like, oh, so the preceding like 7 or 8 or 9 photos of your teddy bear posing with a katana in a rock garden in dramatic poses, those are genuine.
Yeah.
That was not built up to a joke. Okay. Yeah. I see how it is. I don't know. It seems very genuine in its own way. The emotions don't ever feel like exaggerations or like mean-spirited. I don't think this comic like punches down at nerds. It has a very loving hatred of nerds. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But, that kind of
affectionate distaste.
Yes. I mean that's very true of all of these sort of gamer parodies. Is, oh, we're making the humor out of the dysfunction, but like that's how we all are. Which comes off as more endearing in this than Knights of the Dinner Table, which is very, very self-loathing. And this has a lot more, like, knowing smiles more than...
Yeah. This is more Scott Pilgrim than it is the Eltingville Club. If you get either of those touch points.
I mean, Eltingville's way better than Knights of the Dinner Table because it knows what it's doing.
Yeah, Eltingville is a special thing, I think, in nerd culture, and that I can... Minor tangent, because I'm never going to talk about it anywhere else. I can pick the Eltingville Club. I know from the Adult Swim pitch it had, like in, I want to say 1999, 2000. And I'm really glad that wasn't picked up, because I can imagine a universe where the Eltingville Club is an Adult Swim cartoon and a generation of nerds grows up watching it and does not understand it.
Yeah,
because they does not understand why the Eltingville boys are fucking awful.
Yeah. The best successor to it was Casey Green's Anime Club. But that's a comic that completely understands what it's doing. That's not this
unlike Fuzzy Nights. I don't think Fuzzy Nights quite grasps the balance between drama and comedy. Because for one thing, Fuzzy Nights is not, its characters aren't very deep. It wants to have a deep story, but like its characters aren't developed. Mossfoot and Ben are like probably the two most developed characters, unless you count like the weird evil GM hamster villain. What was going on there?
I worked really, really, really hard to find as much of that as possible. Essentially, the hamster is frustrated by being a reflection of the human subconscious, which is what they are.
Yeah, I read that bit. I'm like, where are we going with this?
Yes, and so the hamster is trying to like give them independence by being like the monster under the bed or something. I never really understood what part two of the plan the hamster has is.
I'm not sure it got made, but we'll see.
Yeah, no, I guess that's true. This was setting up for a second part.
And it never got there, right?
Well, we don't know yet. We'll get into that.
We might, yeah.
Yeah.
We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit.
Yeah,
beyond those three characters, like, no, a lot of the Fuzzy Nights cast are just, like, one-shot jokes.
Finally, it's just a rom-com, though.
There's, like, they have the list the evil team of, like, the bad role player archetypes. Like, there's our aforementioned killer DM hamster. But then there's an inattentive, like, actual dog and, like...
Yeah.
A really horny bear who won't shut up and making passes at the girl at the table. And the girl at the table, like the French rabbit who has like Fifi LaFume's accent. She's just a slut. I was like,
well, yeah.
She's like a slut and a super spy. I'm like, these are not good archetypes.
She's a femme fatale. She's a femme fatale bunny. I say that like I'm not a furry.
I know, but like you can't put that in front of me and also expect me to take your deep anthropological analysis of teddy bears seriously.
Yeah, like, she's doing a con in tabletop RPGs, which is like treated like she's running drugs.
I'm sorry, like maybe I'm really dense and I missed the tone, like what the tone was going for, but for the life of me, it did not come together.
I've been on an annoyingly specific nostalgia kick for the exact period of time that this is from. And really? So it was, yeah, like it was a bizarre set of coincidences. It's like made me want to like get back into the RPG. That was my favorite when I was reading this. That happened before we were even rereading this. Now I got pulled into the story both because there is some skill there and also because it was just giving me kind of, admittedly, those warm, fuzzy memories that apparently mean we get 50 Ghostbusters movies for the rest of our lives.
Those warm, fuzzy nights memories.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. Like, there's two things I do really love about this comic. One is when they're describing how Mossfoot and Violet met, that little arc.
Yeah, that was good. I like that.
Really, it parallels the real world experiences of like me and other outcast weirdos who don't fit into their given homes and societies and have to make new ones. And two, not only does it get those occasional bits right, but like this author can be really funny when he's not quoting Monty Python and Doctor Who all the time. Target has really messed up and he says, "Oh, don't give me a lecture about this. I'd rather be whacked in the crotch with a wiffle bat." And Mossfoot says, "Well, this is your lucky day. You get to have both." I just burst laughing at some of these comics.
Yeah,
They're so funny.
When the humor is based on character interaction, it's actually funny.
Yeah, I actually kind of liked the moments where Ben's aggression and ridiculous refusal to listen to instructions actually does pay off.
Yes. And
there's the one selfless moment he has is to like keep Target's character from dying, because if Target's character actually dies, then Target will die because an evil robot has a flamethrower to his back. Like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know. I'm bouncing all over the place on this one because I have so many thoughts.
The comic bounces all over the place on itself, and I think that's why we're like sort of struggling with it here. Is the compositions too? Like talking about the photographs are good. Like as it starts going, the guy has a sense of like
he has a sense of cinematography. Unlike a drawn comic, a photo comic can do things like rack focus the lens to show you one thing in focus and one thing far away.
Yeah. And even just like, you know, dynamic camera angles and the posing and the fight scenes are so much better done than almost anything else in 2003.
Yeah, never mind that they're just immobile toys, but like there's great shots. Like there's one where Ben is arguing and like pointing at the evil hamster, and we see behind we have a weird shot behind the hamster's shoulder, and you can see what's on his GM screen. It's like all the ways he's planning to kill Ben for taunting him. It's really funny. It's like when you take advantage of the angles, you use them to make jokes. It's like it sounds so basic when you say it out loud, but so many comics don't do this.
Yeah, there's and it gets stronger. It like he gets better at that, and it's really finding its stride before it was canceled.
So Fuzzy Nights was I don't know exactly when it stops, but we can't seem to find anything in like 2010, 2011 or so. It was rebooted by the author in 2022, This time as a digitally illustrated comic. There's no more photos. There's no more teddy bears. I mean, the teddy bears are still there, but like they're drawn teddy bears. And the art style is, it's not the best, but like it's okay.
I don't want to diss on it too much, even though it's kind of rough, because the guy is putting himself out there, and I can appreciate
he's just learning how to do this. I think having mastered one medium, I think it's fair to let him experiment in another.
And the continuation is shockingly just tonally in well, for good or ill, it's tonally exactly where it was the original comic.
It's sort of a sequel/reboot where like the toys have been in stasis, being boxed up in a cardboard box for years, and like just wake up because the author is married and has a kid now, and they just start playing role-playing games again like nothing happened.
Ben went crazy because he didn't go inert for like the 20 years they were in the closet.
Some fuzzies go inert, some don't, because again, the comic is still fixated on what keeps the fuzzy animals alive.
And they're already setting up that the central mystery for the author putting an XP of his own kid into the comic, who is now a character in the comic, who's playing D&D with them.
The child is actually in the comic.
And can see them.
And can see the talking animals, and other people can't, which is really confusing.
Yes. If this keeps going the way it's going, that it's going to probably, like, tie back to that as a central thing, because they are...
That author cannot let this go.
Yeah, and I strongly, strongly, strongly suspect has, like, notes for whatever the fuck the evil hamster's plan was. For the original part two, the LARP, which was the UK arc, that was canceled because I believe, and this is my memory from 20 years ago, so not academically viable, but said on a forum in my recollection that Kenzer and Company didn't think it was profitable enough, and so canceled it.
It's an unoriginal reason, but it is a valid reason to and stop supporting a project.
Dude apparently wrote a bunch of books.
Yeah, he became like a real novelist in between then and now. Which, congratulations, that's not easy. I haven't read those books. Maybe I will someday. We have a few pieces of secondary media that we found. Did you read anything from the Fuzzy Knights official RPG?
No, I did not. I could not acquire
Fuzzy
a
Knights,
copy
the
of
role-playing
it.
Game. I have a copy right here. Would you like me to send it to you where we can react to it live on stream?
Yes, yes. Shoot that to me.
Give me just a second.
In my recollection of it, it was supposed to be fairly rules light.
It uses only 3 stats, this tabletop RPG, strength, reflex, intelligence, and everything is just based on that with, I think, like D6s. Even the RPG goes on about the story, the capital S story, and gives you story points. I was like, is this part of the hack or what?
This is an original game. It's got a lot of similarities to a bunch of other games, but it's an original one.
Okay, because it calls your hit points stuffing. You lose stuffing when you're hit. You can take tear factors for permanent damage on your stuffed toy.
It just looks familiar because, like, every RPG at this exact point basically was structured exactly the same way. You have stats, you have skills, you have special abilities specifically unique to you. You have damage tables, whether or not your RPG actually needs a conventional combat system. You have your equipment table, regardless of whether or not you need an actual equipment table. This is very, very typical for mid-2000s game in virtually every respect. And also, this was back when everybody was riding high on, you have points that modify your die rolls.
So it's at least, like, on point.
Yeah.
For like, this is the kind of thing you would have expected to have at the time.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not just a game. It's an arts and crafts project.
I do have, like, some random bizarre trivia.
Hit me.
About this. I know most of the supporting cast was named after active users on the Fuzzy Knights forum. And since these are stuffed animals, you know, there's a lot of Beanie Babies. There's a lot of recognizable characters. I think Dog is like a mascot character from the time, the literal dog. There is a human girl who is like a human plushie.
Uh-huh.
Humanoid plushie who is from Tokimeki Memorial 2.
It was kind of weird for me. Just like some of the stuffed toys in the story are like just Muppets. Like Bert and Ernie are just in there. There's a Big Bird toy. I was like, so when they started talking, like I just heard it in their voices in my head. I was like, this is extremely strange. It's really weird to have Big Bird talking about RPG stuff.
Yes. Part of me does wonder if that might have been why the third volume, because they were printing this, which is how we got the first.
I can't picture that being like legally sound.
Yeah, like
that might have drawn some ire.
It is. Well, they were fine. They were like, oh yeah, don't worry, the Benjamin Bunny plushie is fine. I do kind of think that if they had like Sesame Street plushies, that might have drawn more fire. I don't know how litigious Beatrix Potter's estate is, but I suspect Sesame Workshop, if not like overly so, is a little more legally active. We could talk a little bit about the era it's in and how I was thinking about this, and I'm still developing this timeline in my head, but I would call this a second wave webcomic.
Yeah, I'm trying to, we talked about this a bit off camera before we started. It's like, this is like, it's not one of the earliest webcomics. Second wave, I think, is a good descriptor of it, because like, it's not without like understanding of the conceits of comics. Like, it knows how to use the internet as part of its story. Because like in the first wave of comics, like we read with T.H.A. Fox, it's like it's just a newspaper comic or a comic book.
Yeah.
Just the same format, same attitude, just transplanted to the internet. Whereas with Fuzzy Nights, it's not just on the internet, it's aware that it's on the internet. It can participate with viewers in a way. Like whether that's naming a character after them or like letting them multiple choice the ending at the end of one comic.
And I mean, like a lot, there's like in jokes that were developed on the forum that turn up in the comic. The comic used music. There's a number of
find any of those.
Yeah, those were all dead. I forget exactly. The one I remember most clearly was there's a point where some of the fuzzies are like fighting each other, and it uses the Star Trek like brawling music. Or like when they have the introductions for all of them at the tournament, I remember the Fuzz, which are like furry cops, the Fuzz walk in and all of them have entrance music, and theirs was as Every Step You Take by The Police.
Yeah, there are a couple of like genuinely funny gags. I hated the fact that like the anime girl character kept just saying generic, like she just says like expletives like hentai or sodeska, stuff like that.
It's weird because it's a mixture of lol bad English jokes, but also a bunch of okay, I'm pretty sure there's a weird joke about like that only makes sense if you kind of know Japanese here, which I kind of know, but not enough to get the joke it's trying to make.
Yeah, it's not worth all like the Japanophobic gags, like the anime hating gags. But there was a roundabout joke that when Mossfoot bumps into that character, he earnestly does just speak real Japanese, and they just regular conversation, which is funny. I don't think it was worth all the worrying jokes though.
Yeah.
Some of the things just don't age well. Like there's one point where Violet just says, "Hey Target, we'll talk later, wear a cup," which is really funny, but like, oh, that's just the kind of thing that like Leela Futurama would do. It's just the tough girl character thing. It's like, yeah, I'm gonna kick you in the masculinity.
Or like Hello Kitty. There's a Hello Kitty thing, and Hello Kitty and her gang, their thing is that they're really cute. That's fine. I like that.
That's fine. I liked that they just were consistently cute. I liked the contrast when like Mossfoot is DMing the one group of teddy bears who just have their shit together and are friendly and cooperative, and like that, it's like that's the joke. The joke is that they're the good RPG group who get things done.
But like the thing I want to call out is that Violet gets angry at Hello Kitty for setting back the gender.
That was I remember that sentence. There are a couple of really funny lines like, "Hey, insomnia is a disease, and you're the cure."
And then, you know, it goes back to referencing, which, thanks to all of the giant meta backstory that they're the human subconscious, the reason they're referencing things is actually because since they're the human subconscious, they're recreating human stories, and that's why they're saying stuff that sounds like quotes.
Oh, human stories really seem to involve Monty Python and Doctor Who and Star Wars and Ghostbusters and Chuck Norris over and over again.
Yeah,
you're telling that's just all of human culture distilled right there is those five things.
Yeah,
yeah. It's doing the thing that a lot of like pop culture nerd writers tend to do, and that's like they will. We're going to run into this as we read comics from the 2000s. The it's a reference humor. I call it it's a reference humor because that's the extent of the joke. It's a thing you recognize. It's a staple joke of Family Guy. It's just mentioning a thing that you know, or referencing a thing that you know.
It's like the key thing if you're doing a riff on that is you need to be able to make a joke about the thing you're referencing more than just referencing it. You need to be able to like contextualize it as like the big difference from like the good years of Futurama versus a lot of the stuff that copied it is that Futurama will often make the joke, hey, here's this thing. We're going to take it to its logical possible conclusion. And the absurdity of taking it to its conclusion is the joke as opposed to we're quoting Monty Python.
Yeah. I don't really need to hear the killer rabbit joke one more time. Thank you. Astrea, there is one thing that we do still need to discuss. I know that we didn't mean to review like strictly just furry comics. This is not necessarily a furry comic, despite the fact that it involves like anthropomorphized animals.
Yeah.
And yet, here on comic 35. The fuzzies have stumbled onto using the laptop and are using it to browse the internet, and they look up, what did they look up?
They were just looking for things that had variants of the name Fuzzy Nights.
Fuzzy Night with an N, or Furry Night, or Furry Nights, just see what comes up. And they are quickly vomiting a few panels after that.
Yes.
And saying, goodbye, cruel world.
Because they saw mersuiters, that is, people in fursuits
having sex. And the final panel of this comic reads, online furrydom is not a victimless crime. Every year, thousands of honest cartoonists get forwarded links to sites like the one in today's strip, scarring them for life. No longer can they function properly in our society. Hundreds go blind as they pluck out their own eyes with Q-tips. Dozens more go on homicidal rampages, killing millions. Think of the cartoonists. Think before you link. Only you can prevent furry insanity related syndrome, or FIRS, FIRS for short.
I looked at this like, damn, for 2003, those are amazing suits.
Those are pretty good fursuits for 2003. Yeah. I wonder if we actually know who those are.
Yeah. Hmm. You know, it doesn't seem implausible.
So. Right. They aren't, because like, it's not like these pictures are cited, of course, or anything like that. So Fuzzy Knight's at least aware of furrydom. The geek social hierarchy thing was still going around. Like, furries were always at the bottom, and erotic furries were even lower than that.
The Captain Kirk is an ocelot or something.
Yeah, and like we were way more acceptable targets back then. I wonder why. I wonder which administration it was.
Yeah, and I wonder what furries were primarily known for. Maybe being gay.
I want to go one step beyond that, though. I think Fuzzy Nights is a really furry comic.
It's the it's so incredibly furry. Oh my god.
It's like, I don't just mean like the anthropological fixation. It's just like, it's too genuine. It's too genuine.
Genuine and both justifying and not justifying its like aesthetic. Like, it wants to emphasize its aesthetic. It also has a feature of a lot of furry stuff, which is it emphasizes the physicality of the forms of the characters a lot.
Yeah, you are constantly reminded that they are tiny little creatures.
And that their physiology is based on them being tiny little stuffed animals.
Yeah, and like the thing I mentioned where Mossfoot and Violet met over the internet and didn't fit into their given homes and societies and had to make new ones. That's the queer furry experience.
Yeah, and you know, people will say, oh, that's a nerd thing. It's like, no, it's not quite.
No.
It's not quite.
Not necessarily. And also, hating furries is a very furry thing to do.
Oh, God, is it?
Disliking furries is a really furry thing to do.
Specifically, yeah, that it comes up every time it's like sexual furries, because furries don't ever have sex, right? Like, God.
That's a specific kind of self-hatred that's very easy to spot.
It's interesting because this would have been very, very, very comfortable in like 1980s furry stuff, I feel like the early waves of it, when like the name hasn't quite settled down, where the definitions of it are kind of vague, where like, you know, you the like pre-split where like Usagi Yojimbo and Albedo are culturally the same thing, but because of the different ways the authors diverged, like Usagi Yojimbo is not by a furry creator, but Albedo was, like,
two
of the earliest, like, dramatic furry comics.
Yeah, one of the RPG teams having the motto, "Why should humans have all the fun?"
Yeah.
Is an extremely furry thing to write. Mossfoot starts to feel like a fursona after a while.
Oh, God.
It's not just the fact that the author's voice comes through him the most often. It's also the fact that he was posing cool with a katana and a revolver.
I mean, Mossfoot is like the icon of his website today. Like, all of his old websites used Mossfoot as a mascot before this was even a thing. And he's still using it. Like,
he even posts under the name Mossfoot on the new website. It's like, that is fursona behavior. I'm sorry. There's no getting around that.
Yeah. I don't think this guy was ever in the subculture. It's just weird that it sort of comes around to recreating a lot of the same undercurrents and behaviors.
But like, if he had tested that he wasn't, I would believe him. It's just, it says very interesting things that like somebody who wouldn't be part of it also ends up in the same, like doing a lot of the same parallel things that we do.
Yeah.
For different reasons.
And like, I mean, even putting your friends, your internet friends as characters in your comic is very furry.
I literally do that right now. I'm literally doing that in the card game I'm working on.
Yeah, no, I'm on a page of Calzaria. Like,
it's probably bad form if we read Calzaria, right? That's a conflict of interest.
I would say so. Okay. Yeah, no.
Do you have anything else to say about Fuzzy Nights before we close today?
This was in a weird way, this like sort of set the pace for a lot of my subsequent webcomic reading, because I did consider this when I was 13 to 15, one of the high water marks of webcomics. And looking back on what I was reading,
I think it might have been.
I think it was. Yeah. I think it was. In the context of 2003, this is definitely one of the best ones, despite literally every criticism we have about it. I'm actually really sad how lost it is. Although there is a little part of me, that has a little hope that it might be found again. Because looking at his website, he sort of retells the Mossfoot Violet meet cute story. Mm-hmm. And he just redrew it. And I was like, wait, these are traced from the original panels. And there was a blog post about it. And he has photos of the original panels that are at a much higher resolution than they were published originally. Which gives me hope he still has these archived. And I don't know if they'll ever come back or whatever, but I'd really, really like to see this republished. At the very least, it's a fascinating slice of this time. It is the perfect snapshot of a moment in history, and for all of its tonal issues, I remembered why I had such great affection for it, and it would be very nice to have in a complete format again.
Yeah, I've been punching a little mean this episode, but no, I did love Fuzzy Nights. Fuzzy Nights is fun.
Yeah. I would much rather every comic we're going to eventually read from 2003 to be this. I can already tell.
Have I ever told you about okay, everybody likes to talk about like games or pieces of media that are like 10s out of 10 or 0s out of 10. People like to talk about the extremes of whether something is good or bad. I'm kind of the opposite. I kind of like it when things land in the middle. Because then there's things to talk about. Like a fascinating 5 out of 10, to me, is way more interesting. Because like, if a game is miserable and bad, you don't have anything to say about it. You just hate it. You just hate playing through it. It's not interesting. It's not fun. If a game or a story is a riot, a great time, and everybody agrees and can't really think of anything negative to say, That's also not interesting. I like it when things land in the middle and get your creative, like your art critic brain circuits firing. It's like, okay, yeah. But how could they have done it differently? What made them do it this way? Is this intentional? How much should I lean on this? And in that sense, Fuzzy Nights was a hugely fun read. Yeah, I liked watching it struggle in a weird way.
And like a
sporting way.
Yeah. And for all that it is, like, you know, it is bound by nerd stuff, I could still tell the author had more real life experience than most nerds writing webcomics. Like little things leak through that are like, huh, that's a little bit more grounded. The fact that he was in a stable romantic relationship before he started the comic and it's persisted to this day is kind of unique for this era. So, like, the thing is, for all the issues with Violet, she's still, like, Violet and Mossfoot's relationship is still pretty reasonably healthy compared to a lot of these.
Yeah, it's certainly more, but certainly better and well-adjusted than the rest of their idiot friends.
Yeah, like the fact that there's a stable couple that, like, the joke isn't even favoritism or anything, and they have, like, friction, but they don't hate each other. She's not a nag, and as much as she's, like, you know, that, there is that little thing, even if she is just Leela, she's still more of a person than girls in a lot of webcomics are.
I will give you that. That is true.
Yeah, sure. She's the stock archetype, but
I mean, archetypes exist for a reason.
Yeah, and everybody's archetype.
They let you start somewhere.
Yeah, but yeah, no. For all its flaws, it's a wonderful comic, a very good one from the early 2000s. Singular in so many ways.
What would you like to read next? Because if you don't have a suggestion, I'm afraid I do.
Oh, no. Well, we did. This was the one I pushed for last time, so it seems only fair.
Okay. So we've been avoiding a large topic in webcomics, especially webcomics of the period. I think we have to read a Sprite comic.
Oh, God. Well.
And I do know one that, if you can believe it, is still around after 22 years.
Oh, I thought you were going to recommend one of the two good ones.
No. I was going to recommend Planet Zebeth, a story I haven't read in 20 years or more, but it's still around. The author is still posting it today. We probably won't read all 22 years of it, though. We'll find a nice slice and go from there.
Wow. Okay. I've never even heard of that one. Well, good. I guess we're doing Planet Zebeth next.
Okay. Where can people find you, Astraea?
I'm Automatic Tiger most places. Despite all odds as of this recording, most of them still exist. who knows if that'll be when you're listening to it, but I'm Automatic Tiger. You can find me most actively on Co-Host, assuming Co-Host is still around when you can hear this cast. I'm Automatic Tiger also on Twitter, and also on Blue Sky, although I pretty much just reblog furry art on both of those platforms.
And I'm Cups of Jade. I make furry art on most of those platforms. You can find me at Cups of Jade most places. I have a link tree. And we will see you next time for episode 6. Bye-bye.
Bye.